concerns. And there were farmers here who at that time of year were able to come, who spoke very clearly about their concerns. They were concerns that were reiterated this evening by people such as Gilbert Schaud and Bill Strader and Mike McCarthy and our friend from Multnomah County, who talked about small farms and operations. One of the things I would like to suggest that it's important to keep in mind is whether you ask the Association of Realtors for their recommendations on what kind of problems agriculture has, or whether you ask Oregon Farm Bureau or Agriculture for Oregon. One of the questions you have heard talked about continually was, and certainly in the Senate hearings it came up, and I'm sure you're going to be hearing it further, is that certainly the legislature should not be looking at marginal lands. LCDC should perhaps do this. I would like to take you back just briefly to the comments Hector McPherson made on your last hearing when he talked about the process that Agriculture for Oregon used to arrive at the initial draft was that the Senate committee began with. It was a group of farmers and agriculturalists, ranchers from about 9 counties in the state, including people like Bill Strader from Douglas County, and with telephone consultation frequently with people like Floyd Hawkins in Malheur County. There was a wide variety of types of agriculture that was involved. There was consultation, for instance, in Benton County with several very, very small farmers who might be making I can think of one neighboring farmer to our operation who is doing a very intensive operation on less than 10 acres. There was discussion and review with many, many farmers on what kind of things would, in the long term, protect Oregon's land use laws and agricultural land protection in such a way, if we could loosen up, but tighten. And you see, this is the bill that has come out of that. Now, I would ask that you, a legislative committee, and the House of Representatives take action on some kind of bill that has to do with marginal lands. And we believe, Agriculture for Oregon believes, that for the most part, the bill you have in front of you provides a good definition of marginal lands. I've got some amendments in the written testimony that we'll go through in just a moment that we would like to suggest. We think that in the last session of the Senate hearing, some amendments were adopted which loosen it too broadly and that you need to pull back somewhat. But somebody needs to come up with a draft. In 4 years, when you come back to the legislative session, you may wish to look at this after it's been adopted around that long. You may wish to look at it and say, okay, it can be defined in a different way. We need to tighten it here, loosen it here. It doesn't quite meet the criteria. But somebody needs to say, okay, let's begin with this criteria, with a specific criteria. And I would encourage you to adopt a specific criteria, SB 237, as with the proposed amendments that Ag for Oregon is going to offer. LCDC has a very large task at hand immediately, and that is to finish reviewing the comprehensive plans of many counties and many jurisdictions. And we don't think that they ought to be given the hot potato of what is marginal lands. As you can hear from the testimony, there is a lot of difference.
Mr. Chairman,
who is proposing that? I hadn't heard that suggestion before. Who is proposing that LCDC draft the definition of marginal lands?
And that was the recommendation the Association of Oregon Counties made to the Senate Committee, and I would assume, although I haven't seen their written amendments, that may be coming from there. Because the feeling of the counties was, well, let's not the legislature do it, let's let LCDC do it.
That's very surprising to me, because that's the same association that comes in and on other issues tells us that they don't want the LCDC to have those kinds of determinations, but they want the policy to be decided by the legislature. So now they're urging the legislature not to make the policy decision, but to have LCDC do it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Throop, I cannot speak for Oregon counties. You'll need to talk to them when they testify. That needs to be directly from them, not
just
hearsay.
Just confused
from
them. Me, Ed.
I'm sorry.
I'm used to hearing from Oregon counties.
Right. I'd like to speak just briefly, yet in these introductory comments, to the previous testimony from the realtors. Mrs. Weaver talked about the problems of small farmers. That's one thing that Agriculture for Oregon was concerned about. That's one reason why in the marginal land definitions we said if there is land that is already parcelized and where there is pressure to bring that down further, then somehow that land should be made available for hobby farmers, for part-time farmers that do make a contribution to Oregon agriculture. One of the problems that happens, we thought that Rural Residential 10, for instance, in Benton County would provide that. We found then that Rural Residential 10, instead of staying at 10-acre minimum, went down to RR2. And so those parcels that would have been available for small farm operations were no longer available for them. So in a marginal land zone where there is a specific minimum lot size, there would be the possibility of holding that for small-time farmers. Let me run through the written testimony just in outline. You have heard a lot, much testimony this evening about the phrase significant contribution on page 2, line 2. We also agree that significant contribution would be a lawyer's dream. We tried to weed out litigation terms in the version the bill first introduced. We urge the committee to remove this term. On line 2, page 2, the land did not make a contribution to a farm operation that produced $20,000. I would also like to speak to the problem of a specific dollar income. You have heard testimony, and I'm sure you'll continue to hear more, that you are entering into the problems of the privacy of farmers when you ask what that previous income was. I would comment that any commercial operation, any full-time farm operation that does not gross in annual income $20,000 or more just isn't a full-time operation. I prepared for Senator Day and the Senate E&E Committee a memo on how much does it take to produce $10,000 for another portion of this bill. And I will try to get copies of that to members of this committee also, because that may help you to see. The other thing to keep in mind is that it has been taken for granted ever since the farm use assessment has been on the books in Oregon, that the assessor could eyeball or could make a general idea and could make a general observation of whether this was a commercial operation producing $20,000 or more. I don't think that's a problem. I think the assessors know how to do it. I think that if it's a part of a commercial operation, it is obviously producing more than $20,000. And that was what Ag for Oregon was trying to protect. We were trying to protect those lands that were presently in commercial operations. Second point, on page 2, line 5, we would like to have you delete 100 and insert 320. The figure 320 acres was reduced to 100 by the Senate Committee at its last rushed work session without opportunity for consideration of its impact. With a passage of 2 weeks since that action, it's become evident in talking to our members in areas of intensive agriculture that reducing 320 to 100 acres is a mistake. It will work contrary to our intent. That is, it will cause the loss of high-quality farmlands that can contribute to commercial agriculture. If areas as small as 100 acres are eligible and only 50% of the area need to be in ownerships 20 acres or smaller, the amount of marginal land will increase dramatically. And then I illustrate here an example of 100 acres. Any of the above parcels not part of a 20,000 farm is marginal land by this definition. Few forested tracts, even of 50 acres, gross 20,000 annually. In farm areas, if one or more of the tracts happen to be in pasture or lying fallow, they too would be marginal land. 100 acres should be changed back to 320 acres. 50% should be changed to 60%. In the A and gross version, that 50% was 70%, and we think that 60 might be a good medium. These changes will help ensure only truly parcelized areas with little opportunity for consolidation will fall into marginal land. Those parcelized areas that should be in marginal land, we want to have go in, but we don't want additional land to go in unnecessarily that should be protected for Oregon's economic base of commercial agriculture. Number 3, on page 2, line 5, after composed of, delete the word contiguous. What we're talking about here, and as the checkerboarding problem there, and I won't read that further. You can read that for yourself. But the proposed language will avoid this unintended result. The next proposal, the next amendment we're suggesting in number four, is that there will be a, and this was something that we overlooked initially, that somehow this not mushroom. We want the proposed language to ensure that new parcels created as a result of being marginal land cannot then, in the future, be used to convert areas of large ownerships into marginal land. You see, in 1983, we zoned 100 acres as marginal land. In 1984, on the basis of the division that occurred in 1983, we can zone another 100-acre parcel into marginal land. With changes 2, 3, and 4 above, the small ownerships test would read, and then I give you language. Number 5, on page 4 of your bill, line 25, we would like to have you delete farm unit or woodlot and insert lot or parcel. Our intent is to require performance or commitment by the applicant before a dwelling is built on a small parcel. Here is the problem. Any smart person intent upon building a rural residence on a small parcel in a farm area can beat the $10,000 standard by leasing his small tract for 2 years to a farmer making more than $10,000 in annual gross income. At the end of the second year, the person comes in with the farmer's records and gets a building permit because his small parcel was managed as part of a farm, making at least $10,000 in 2 consecutive years. The problem is an oversight. It can be remedied by changing farm unit or woodlot on line 11 to lot or parcel. On number 6, on page line 4, line 36, after courses, we're talking about golf courses here, insert on land with soils predominantly in capability classes 3 through 8, as determined by AC Agriculture Capability Classification System, and so forth. The idea, and go back down to the third paragraph in section 6, our concern about loss of good land has been reawakened by a proposed golf course on excellent farmland in Subi Island, one of Oregon's best stretches of farmland. The language we propose is a middle ground in contrast with the first recommendation of Ag for Oregon. It would authorize golf courses on soil classes 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. If someone wanted to build in Oregon small amount of class 1 or 2 soil, he would have to take an exception. As we understand it, the exceptions process is to be changed. We feel this is an important compromise. Our seventh recommendation is that sections 7 and 8 from the initial version of Senate Bill 237 be incorporated. Section 7 requires counties to establish a panel of farmers to review applications for farm dwelling, non-farm dwellings, and land divisions. Our rationale for this is that as we listen to testimony from realtors and county planners and so forth, we feel that oftentimes they don't really understand what commercial agriculture requires, what is commercial agriculture building, what is involved there, and we feel that those involved in commercial agriculture could make that decision. They would not be making legislative decisions. They would be making decisions about permits. Section 8 is one that we feel was very, very important. And I think Gilbert Schott's testimony from Clackamas County gives you another basis for why it is important. We believe that farmers should have standing. In fact, our feeling, although we did not speak to this in Forest Zone, is that anyone in a resource zone should have, who is, for instance, a farmer in an EFU zone, should be able to challenge and have standing in court to challenge the action of any farmer in that county, in that resource zone. And we think a parallel appeal right for or standing right in a forestry zone would be appropriate. It simply is too costly in litigation for counties and the farmers to go through the appeals of standings. We recently came through a case that went clear to the Supreme Court on a standing issue. We went through another case, we being farmers in Benton County. We went through another case where we went back and forth from LUBA and to appeals court on a standing issue. In every case, standing was granted, but the cost to the county, the cost to the taxpayers, the cost to the farmers was very steep. Someone referred in their testimony this evening to the life estate section. That was included in Section 5 of the original bill simply as an educational technique for planners. It was deleted from the last bill. We think it would be a good idea for that to be restored. That is not part of my written testimony, but I would certainly ask that you consider, simply as a reminder, that a life estate is a good provision when a farmer wishes to remain on the land but sell his farm because he needs the income.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hill. Lewis, what is that again? What section of the
original? Okay, the original bill, it was in Section 5, and I don't have the original copy with me, but Section 5, I believe, is the permitted uses in EFU lands, and I think it had a small H in front of it, but I'm not sure that's the accurate detail there. In any case, what it did was simply put in the statute something which is possible to do legally now. And we thought that was a good idea, and I'm not sure why there was opposition to it, but it was taken out. It certainly does not put anything new in except some educational material. One more thing I'd like to add that is not in my written testimony. On page 5, line 28.
Excuse me, Representative Hill.
That's Section 5 of the Ingros version.
I believe so.
It's not in the original bill I just looked, but it's in the Ingros.
What line is the Section 5?
It's page 5, line 38, and continues on to page 6, I think. No, it's just on page 5 of Ingros. I'm sorry.
I have an incorrect notation here on my next comment. And this has to do in the permitted use section in EFU, and I can't find it, and I won't even try. But in the statutes as they presently exist for permitted uses in EFU, schools are part of that. The interim task force, I believe, recommended that schools go into conditional uses so that communities could decide. You could have some local control over where schools go. There was some deep fear when the initial bill came out, and churches were going to go into conditional use too, that there would be some possibility of loss of religious freedom, loss of personal freedom for private schools to be started or for Bible study groups or prayer meetings to be held. And so in order to get away from the hot potato, the whole thing went back to the way it presently was, with one exception. In the school area, language was added, and as I said, I can't find it tonight. Language was added to allow boarding schools or any buildings necessary for a school to be in a permitted use. Now, I have absolutely no objection to boarding schools being in EFU zones or wherever they are best suited. But I do think a community has a right to have a discussion on that. I think, in a sense, you're taking away some degree of community control and local control. And Agriculture for Oregon, and I personally also feel that that would be far better in the conditional uses rather than permitted use. And we would respectfully request that you amend that particular action that the Senate took and change the boarding school from a permitted use to a conditional use. I certainly would hope that our county officials would not in any way deny anyone's religious freedom or educational freedom although, again, with reports of Clackamas County problems, knowing some of my Benton County problems, I'm not sure what would happen. One more thing, if I may just say, in relationship to Benton County and marginal lands, after our assistant legal counsel, Mr. Condit, testified, the marginal lands bill was not meant for Benton County. Benton County doesn't have an acre of soil, that's an exaggeration, but almost, that isn't either good farmland or good forestry land. And when you think about it, I'm not a forester, but I'm neighbors to foresters. I live in Corvallis with a school of forestry, school of agriculture. When you think about that, any tree that grows in the Northwest grows bigger and better here, that we have soils and climate that all around the world they would give a great deal to have for forestry products. And then we talk about making, cubic site class 200 and less be marginal land in the Willamette Valley. It's absolutely absurd. We have a resource here, just like our farmland, that should not be wasted and considered marginal land. The only criteria for marginal land in the Willamette Valley should be whether it's already parcelized, and if it is, okay, then let's keep it in parcels. Not much smaller, if they haven't already been broken down that far, not much smaller than 20 acres, so they can be used for for small hobby-type or part-time farming. But let's not say, well, it isn't any good because we don't have any marginal land on our forestry land in the Willamette Valley. We shouldn't have any marginal land, and it was not created for that. It was created to take care of the needs where people in Southern Oregon and Eastern Oregon said, hey, look, land use isn't fair to us. It just doesn't meet our needs. So excuse me for being eloquent and for being on my soapbox.
Thank you, Lois. I hope it doesn't rain Friday,
on Friday.
And I hope it doesn't get too hot either.
Oh, thank you, thank you. I hope it doesn't rain tomorrow.
Representative Bradbury.
I want to go back to one of the first things you talked about, which was the income test on farms. I guess my question is sort of, we do have a legal test here about the $20,000. And it seems to me that there's going to have to be some way beyond just the assessor looking at it and saying, oh, yeah, that's $20,000. That you're going to have to establish that figure, don't you think?
I don't see that as a problem. I mean, maybe I've got a simple mind, but it would seem to me that what you would do would be to have somebody fill out an affidavit saying I'm either over or under $20,000, my gross income. Now, that's not exactly private information. I mean, maybe if you're 19.5 or 25 or something, you don't want anybody to know exactly where you are. But the under or over, I would not guess, would be a problem.
Lois?
Well, can I just one follow-up question? Following up on that, let's, on one hand, I think in terms of farms that want to stay as farms and their commercial operations, I think you're correct. Let's look at it from the other side, someone who is interested in abusing this law, okay? And they have a farm that probably produces more than $20,000 in gross income, but they decide to sign an affidavit that they don't.
You know, you're going to have abuses. If you have abuses, I would rather take their affidavit. I think that, again, this would be where you'd have a panel of farmers or a farm consultant group that could give you some general counsel. I mean, it doesn't seem to me you don't have to go look at their income tax report. I think our extension agent, I think the one of the agriculture consultants that we hire to work with our family farm could easily say, sure, that is over a $20,000 operation, or that's under a $20,000 operation. A commercial operation has to be over $20,000, or believe me, it's not a commercial operation in terms of gross income.
Lois, we had testimony, I lose track of meetings, but Oregon State, I believe it was Oregon State, puts out a yearly booklet showing average yield, at least, for strawberries or wheat or whatever.
Right.
What do you think about using that as a guideline?
That'd be excellent. That's just one of many guidelines. And again, I would like to go back to Mrs. Weaver's comments, and I'm not sure I got them down correctly, but she was talking about the majority of farms. She is talking about farms from the U.S., I would guess, from the U.S. Census viewpoint, where anything that earns more than $2,500 gross is considered a farm. Now, those people do make, as we have said, Ag for Oregon says, you know, hobby farms and part-time farms are valuable and important. We do not try to eliminate them. But that's not the commercial agriculture that makes Oregon that makes Oregon agriculture Oregon's number one industry. You see what I'm saying? You know, and when you take that broad definition of farms, where commercial farms are only one small part of it, then you're going to get into trouble thinking about $20,000. If you're going to take commercial farms, you have no problems. What we didn't want to do was take away the poor land from the rancher who needed that for wintering. I think my husband testified some months ago before you that we own one beautiful 90-acre rectangle. It's marvelous. You know, we can put a circle pivot and irrigate our sweet corn there. But the tragedy is that we've had to take a corner of that field and build a machine shop because we don't own any land that has bad soil. You know, that's part of the problems with...
Lois, we heard testimony several witnesses back, I think an orchardist, who said according to this bill he thought that you could divide off marginal land out of a larger farming operation. Is that true?
Well, I'm not sure that I followed Mike McCarthy's testimony clearly enough or carefully enough to know exactly how he meant that. I do know that we are very concerned about the 100 acres instead of 320 acres, and also about the loophole that we did not close initially, which is talked about on my point number four, where the breaking up into small parcels could multiply and year by year.
Well, I'm particularly interested in that. I wonder if your group could come back and answer that question for us. It's come up two or three different times.
Okay. We'll take a clear look at that. I think this is part of the answer, but we'll look at it again, Representative Anderson. I appreciate your request on that. Yeah, and I really appreciate your commitment to work at something on marginal lands, not because I think much land is marginal in Willamette Valley, but because I want Oregon's land use program to be workable for protection of commercial agriculture. Our kids are just right now going into the commercial ag thing with us. And so it's no longer just for Cliff and me. Now we're talking about it for our four kids. And I want commercial agriculture to work. It's part of what makes Oregon, to use that familiar phrase. And I think we've got to keep good land use planning, and that means giving some kind of redress to those people who have had valid complaints.
Thank you, Lois.
Thank you very much for your time, and again, forgive my fatigue.
I'd like to apologize to some of you people here. Some of us have been literally, Representative Troop has been putting in 10, 12-hour days beyond his regular floor session on the select committee. I know I had three committees today. I got out of the last one at 6:30, and I had a banana and a granola bar and came in here. And we're trying to get through this, and as long as some of you want to stay, I'm going to take a couple of more. I told the committee we're going to end at 9 o'clock, but I'm going to try to... I know we're not going to get to all these, and I've tried to get to some of you out in the audience to see if you can't come back on Friday. But I'd like to take a couple of more anyhow, and I'd like to go with Alan Nuringer from Washington County.
I'm Alan Nuringer, a member of Action 80. Our main claim to fame is that we've been in opposition to Jim Allison and his group for the past 5 years. It's been a hard battle. He's a worthy opponent, as you well know. We've been basically supportive of trying to protect farm and forest land out in Washington County. That, too, has been a hard battle. I'll be very brief. I find myself basically in agreement with Mr. Allison, surprise, surprise, as to the need for a marginal lands bill, and I think basically this is a good vehicle. But I see some major problems, and I'll just mention two, one of which has already been talked about. The first being what one could refer to as creeping sprawl or creeping development. That is, if you have land which is in less than 20-acre lots, next to, say, a 100-acre parcel, you can divide that 100-acre parcel if it meets some of the other criteria. You could then next year use the 200 acres of divided land, which is adjoining a 200-acre parcel, to divide up 400 acres. I think that's a major oversight. There's one oversight, however, that has been mentioned. There's one additional problem, which I think has not been mentioned. I personally own about 80 acres of forest land in a portion of the county which is in the middle of the forested area. It's in no one's view marginal land. According to this bill, I'm afraid that prime forest land can be divided. That is to say, the authors of the bill put in a $20,000 criterion to protect the prime farmlands from development. If any piece of farmland has grossed more than $20,000 in the past year, it cannot be divided, even if it meets other criteria. Forest land will rarely gross $20,000 in 3 out of the last 5 years unless it's in a sustained yield situation, and there's a lot of land that is not. And I see a major oversight in that prime forest land can be divided. That is independent of this 85 down in, well, I have this version of it, page 2, lines 9 through 14, the 85 cubic feet criterion. That is to say, if it doesn't meet B, the land does not make $20,000, and is next to land which has been divided up already, even though it's prime forest land, it can be divided. I think it's an oversight. I think it's very, very serious. I think it has to be dealt with, perhaps in the same way that you're trying to deal with some criterion to preserve the prime farmland. That is to say, there should be some criterion to protect forest land, which is potentially productive forest land.
Alan, do you have a suggestion what that criteria should be?
Well, it can't be, it cannot be a gross amount of money over the past 3 out of 5 years. One possible suggestion is a site classification of the soil, if it is potentially able to produce. Another possibility is to look over the last 20 years or 30 years with respect to forest land. Has it been productive forest land over that size? I'm not sure that would work either. So I don't at the moment have a specific suggestion, but I think it's essential. Otherwise, you're going to find that I'm sure that in my area, excellent forest land would be divided into 20-acre lots because of this bill. No one, even in Washington County, wants to do that, but it would happen.
I think earlier we did ask the staff to ask invited testimony in from the Department of Forestry and so on. Maybe we can, I do want to take a look at the types of forest land and see where we want, might want to go that way. Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Russ Niebaum.
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to be out of state on Friday, and there are other county planning directors that do have other comments that they want to give, but I will give mine as briefly as I can tonight. And